Yeah, in slum national, underground, thunder bounce when I stomp the ground. Like a million elephants, a silverback, orangutans, you can't stop a train. Who wants some, don't come unprepared, I'll be there. But when I leave there, better be a household name.
If you're confused by the music, don't be tripping, because this is still Locked On Heat, and this show is still the bomb. Our theme this week is going back to three different years in franchise history. You've entered a time machine taking you to 2000. Of course, in the future, you'll be able to subscribe to the show on Apple or Google Podcasts, Spotify, or in Himalaya, assuming there is a future. Of course, we're still very scared of the Y2K virus. And I am still David Ramil. If you're listening to this in 2020, you're in luck, because today's Blast from the Past is brought to you by Built Bar, the best-tasting protein bar of any era. If you didn't hear yesterday's episode, the time machine is basically our theme for the week. Our founder, Utah Jazz radio broadcaster David Locke, picked 3 years at random. We'll go back in time, talk about the Miami Heat during those seasons. I did a first show on 1990. It was a young Heat team that was still trying to find an identity, being coached by Ron Rothstein. This is a little different as we're waiting for basketball being resumed, hopefully at some point in 2020. This takes us back two decades earlier to the year 2000. 1999-2000 season began the same way as the previous one, and with a playoff loss to the New York Knicks. The 98-99 season was cut short by greedy owners, locking out of their players who renegotiate the collective bargaining agreement after a number of players had signed long-term deals that owners felt was too much money after they had already given those players too much money. During the shortened season, the Heat were hungry to establish themselves in the Eastern Conference following the second retirement of Michael Jordan, and they were, in fact, the top team in the Eastern Conference. They faced the eighth-seed New York Knicks in the playoffs, the third straight year the two teams had matched up in the playoffs, but the Heat, unfortunately, would lose in dramatic fashion, as always. That was the Game 5 loss in the first round of the playoffs to Allen Houston's game winner in Game 5 of the first round. Perhaps one of the worst shots in Heat history. I'm trying to think of any other one shot that was much of a soul-crushing shot as that was. I can still picture it if I close my eyes, bouncing off the front rim, hitting the backboard, and then dropping through. I may have told this story before. It was the era of the VCR and being able to record games. And unfortunately, I had a family function that I had to attend. Could not watch Game 5. I was upset about it. But you know what? I was confident for whatever reason that Miami would find a way to win. So I taped the game, knowing full well that when I would play it later on, this was the era before the internet, of course. There were no updates, no Woj bombs, nothing of that sort. If you weren't in front of the TV, if you were plugged in watching it, you didn't know about that score until you saw the paper the next day or heard the news later on that night. Either way, I tried to remain as isolated from the news as possible, recorded the game, came back, and I turned on my TV, and there it was with the Heat holding on to a slim lead, and the shot was just about to be taken, and I was frozen. I didn't know what to do. I had the option of shutting down the recording or just, you know, watching the last second of the game or letting it record and then rewatching it later on. I took my chances. I said, oh, you know what? This is too exciting. I can't pass it up. That was a foolish decision. And I got to watch it live as it played out, watching Allen Houston's game-winning shot. But either way, demoralizing loss again, probably the worst one. But that was in 1999. The Knicks would advance to the NBA Finals. They'd lose to Tim Duncan for the first of his five championships. Moving on to the 99-2000 season, the Heat were obviously a good team, so there were only the need to make minor changes to the roster. One of those was adding Otis Thorpe as a free agent. He was another big body with championship experience. He had played for the Houston Rockets in 1993. He had gone to the All-Star at one point during his career, and he won a title in 94. So he had some, you know, he was a veteran presence, a guy who could be play the four or the five. He was a big body and a capable rebounder. And again, that veteran presence for a team that needed a boost, some confidence after having lost to the Knicks for two straight seasons. And not quite sure whether or not they had absolute championship aspirations, but maybe they were lacking something as far as the championship drive is concerned. That was probably a concern, and that's why you add a guy like Thorpe. But the season was a successful one, at least in the regular season. It was the fifth straight season with Pat Riley as the head coach after having taken over in 1995. Four straight trips to the playoffs already, but they'd been eliminated by the Bulls or the Knicks on every occasion. And the moment, although it was less than ideal, I kind of remember it that it was a very different feeling from today's game, where players have to win a championship in order to establish their legacies, and they'll do whatever it takes to achieve that goal. This was about a lot less player movement. You didn't have players joining team to team. You certainly didn't have, you had guys, you know, kind of title chase a little bit, but that was really, really at the end of their career. It wasn't, you didn't see anything the way that we do in today's league. And I'm not passing judgment. It was just a very different scenario. And if you've seen The Last Dance and you've seen what Michael Jordan went through, I think it was just kind of an understanding. The thought process was, you know, that you had to pay your dues. You know, the Pistons had done it earlier on, getting past the Boston Celtics. The Bulls did it, getting past the Pistons. And the Knicks and the Pacers were perennial challengers who had constantly challenged the Chicago Bulls, but just hadn't been able to get past Michael Jordan at any point in order to win their championship, even though Patrick Ewing and the Knicks had been able to carry the team in 1994 and lose to the Houston Rockets. But either way, it was still, you know, it was just a part of the process. That's just the understanding, was that you had to do it. And I also don't think that you had to, you know, win a championship at all costs. I don't think that that reality had set in yet. It was one that Jordan and his fans eventually created, that you had to win a title in order to say that you are a winner, that you are a all-time great. I think that really changed the narrative so much. And you kind of see some of that thought process with Jordan in that documentary, where, you know, he was so cold-blooded and ruthless. And I imagine, although he couldn't have created himself, his constant, you know, the one thing he could always loom over either Patrick Ewing or Charles Barkley or everything else was six rings. That's it. That's the only thing he had over Karl Malone. I mean, he was a great scorer, great individual player, without a doubt, but he was also a six-time champion, something that neither Ewing or you know, Malone or any of those other players could claim to. And so that was where the narrative started changing, even though, of course, there's always a player like Bill Russell who's won 11 titles, or even a role player like Robert Horry who's won a bunch of rings too. So the rings argument began with Jordan, but I don't think it had set in so much in 99-2000. And so I don't think there was any kind of desperation from Pat Riley to make immediate changes to the roster. The eight-man rotation was a really solid group. It was Tim Hardaway, Dan Majerle, Jamal Mashburn, PJ Brown, and Alonzo Mourning, of course. Anthony Carter, Vashawn Leonard, and Clarence Weatherspoon were the most productive players to round off that eight-man rotation, followed by Thorpe, who, again, could play either the four or five, and then Bruce Bowen, who played in 27 games that year. He was with the 76ers after his first stint with Miami. Then he was traded from the Sixers to the Bulls, and they immediately cut him. This was the rebuilding season after Michael Jordan's retirement, so they didn't really need a guy like Bowen, who, you know, he was a guy who needs a very specific fit, and didn't really have one in Chicago. They cut him, and then in February 2000, he wound up signing with the Miami Heat as a free agent, and he played the rest of the year with the Heat as well as the next season. But this was the beginning of the end in some regards, and the first domino fall would be Tim Hardaway in his ailing knee. He missed 30 games that season from November to January as a result, and Anthony Carter wound up filling in for him as a solid defender who could get to the rim. He actually upped his per-game average to a respectable 10.6 points per game, but it was already kind of, like I said, the beginning of the wall, the end, you could see the writing on the wall as far as Hardaway's health was concerned. If you recall, the original reason why he was available to the Heat as an impending free agent back in 1996 was that his knees were somewhat bulky during the earlier part of his career in Golden State. Miami would famously get Hardaway into great shape, having him meet certain body fat standards that were in place during every year of his career, just as they are now. And Hardaway kind of bristled at those. And either way, whether he was in great shape or not, he still wound up being, prone to injury issues throughout the rest of his career. And we started to see that specifically during this season as he missed 30 games. But I'll get into how that impacted Miami's season, what they did in their new location, and much more. You're listening to Locked On Heat. So I wanted to tell you about something that happened. We finally finished up our last box of Built Bar protein bars, and we were so bummed out. This was a product that we have come to rely on, and unfortunately, my wife and I, we just went through them all too quickly. And although we were trying to preserve it, we're going to be on that website pretty soon ordering our next box, because after you've tasted them, you'll be just as blown away as we are. Protein bars, they don't necessarily taste pretty good, but the ones that do taste okay, aren't particularly good for you. So you're always kind of trying to navigate how to balance taste with actual protein and health and all the different things that you might be looking for out of a protein bar. Built Bar is the only one that actually achieves that balance. They taste like a candy bar, and they've got the nutrients that you're looking for, 21 different flavors. So you're bound to find one that you absolutely love. Everyone around the network swears by them, and that is unprecedented, that you'll find so many people who are just so interested in a product and really swear by it. And right now, you're lucky enough that if you go to BuiltBar.com and you use a promo code, just as I will, use the promo code LOCKEDON, you'll get $10 off your first order. So go to BuiltBar.com, use the promo code LOCKEDON, and get $10 off your first order of a great tasting protein bar that's good for you too. On December 28th, the Heat had their last home game at the Miami Arena, and just a few days later hosted the Orlando Magic for their first home game in the America Airlines Arena, a state-of-the-art facility on the Bay that was, for a long while, probably the best in the NBA. The Heat actually won that first game against their interstate rival, 111-103. But as I was mentioning before, Hardaway's injury would continue to nag him throughout the season and his career, really. He'd have good games, but he was relying more on his outside shot. He wasn't really taking all that many three-pointers, but it just seemed like that was a bigger part of his arsenal. He wasn't getting to the rim. He wasn't explosive. He didn't have that crossover to the same efficiency as he had earlier. His athleticism was absolutely waning. But the Heat were deep, and Zoe was absolutely at the peak of his abilities. He carried that team to a 52-30 record and won his second straight Defensive Player of the Year award, putting up phenomenal numbers. 21.7 points, 9.5 rebounds, and a ridiculous 3.7 blocks per game in 79 appearances. He actually only started 78 games, and I wonder what the story was behind that game in which he came off the bench. But still, it was a really good team, and the feeling was that maybe if they could get Hardaway back at nearly full strength, they'd have just as good a chance against anyone. If they met the Knicks or face any other team in that Eastern Conference, they'd be able to get past them and eventually make it to their first NBA Finals. They finished second overall in the Eastern Conference. They faced the Detroit Pistons in the playoffs for that first opening round. The Indiana Pacers were the first seed that year. The Pistons were dealing with injury issues of their own, and their star, Grant Hill, was nursing ankle injuries that would unfortunately plague him throughout the rest of his career. Hardaway would actually sit out the Pistons series, but Hill would not. Probably a bad decision, one that many players, as recently as Kevin Durant, have made throughout NBA history. You take a chance that you're going to be able to play at full strength or work your way past an injury. That's just the mentality that you can kind of grit through the performance as Myers Leonard or his wife Ellie told me, you can just kind of rub a little dirt in it and get right past it. But unfortunately, that wasn't the reality for Hill, who probably could have been one of the all-time greats and probably was still an all-time great if you take his whole basketball career into consideration. Obviously, I'm still a member of the Basketball Hall of Fame, but we never really quite saw his potential fulfilled at the highest level. And so that's one of the bigger what-ifs in NBA history. Either way, Anthony Carter would wind up starting in place of Hardaway, and the Heat had more than enough talent to sweep Detroit in three straight games. This was during the time period when, you know, the opening round of the playoffs was just a five-game series, best of five. So you, the first to win three games would advance to the next round. And the Heat did move on, and they would face the third-seeded Knicks in the next round of the playoffs. The Heat had a 3-2 series in that lead, despite Tim Hardaway shooting just 29%. So the plan did not work the way they had wanted it to. They were hoping that Hardaway would rest up during the Pistons series and he would come back to face the Knicks at full strength, or again, close to it, and that he would be able to at least be somewhat effective. That really wasn't the case. He never scored in any game, never scored more than 15 points, and just struggled mightily. He went, I think he had 1 point in one game. I mean, just a horrific series from him. Again, only 29% overall in the series. But the Heat actually still managed to hold on to a 3-2 lead. They would lose Game 6 to New York, however, just by 2 points after blowing a 15-point lead. They were up 45-30, and then the Knicks found a way to come back and take that lead, and again, a 2-point victory for New York. Game 7, however, was back in Miami, and so the Heat had to like their chances, although both teams had managed to win on the road, but still Miami, they were at the American Airlines Arena. They had the playoff intensity there. This was different. This was an all-new season. This was a restart of everything that had happened. And it looked like Miami would actually be able to pull away with a victory. It was Game 7. You had teams that weren't versing, you know, they weren't scoring very much. No team really eclipsed 90 points except for one occasion there or a couple of occasions on most. There wasn't really like, you weren't putting up 115 points. And so an 11-point lead, this wasn't the era where, you know, you had Steph Curry or even the Big Three era Heat where you could close a lead within seconds. That wasn't the case. An 11-point lead was insurmountable in many cases. Unfortunately, this was not one of those cases because the Latrell Sprewell and Larry Johnson combination would wind up helping the Knicks claw their way past that lead and eventually cut it to they actually wind up taking the lead themselves. A Hardaway three-pointer wind up giving Miami an 82-81 lead until Patrick Ewing drove past Alonzo Mourning for a one-point lead of their own. I rewatched that play, and it was pretty bad. Alonzo actually went for the steal. He took a gamble there that on the entry past him, the Ewing, that he could get the steal or poke it away from him, and so that Ewing wouldn't be able to have an opportunity to get a basket or a look at the hoop. There was no weak side help. He went for the gamble. Maybe he expected P.J. Brown or somebody else to be there. Nobody was really there. He gambled, took a chance. I'm not sure what he was thinking, to be honest with you. Maybe he was just a little overly aggressive on his point, but he took the chance, and Ewing wound up scoring. There was still plenty of time left on the clock, though. That was the whole thing. It was a minute 30 left in the game. And so you think to yourself, man, you could put up 10 points in that span in today's era. That was not the case in 2000. And no team actually scored for the next minute and a half until the final player of the game, which was one that a lot of Heat fans remember pretty closely. Unfortunately, it was an entry pass to Alonzo Mourning, who immediately drew a double team. Mourning would wind up kicking the ball out, probably a mistake. Maybe he could have challenged the double team and tried to put up the shot, but instead he wound up kicking it out to Jamal Mashburn, who was immediately surrounded by, I think Charlie Ward went over to defend him right away, and Mashburn felt the pressure of that defense. Kicked it out to a wide-open Clarence Weatherspoon along the baseline. Weatherspoon was open from about 18 to 19 feet. Could have probably taken that shot. Not in his wheelhouse, however. So Weatherspoon wasn't really expecting that pass, wasn't really expecting to take that shot. And although he can hit 19-footers, not necessarily the strength of his game. He was a 3-4, but you know, kind of one of those tweener players where he was an undersized active rebounder. Probably a guy who was better playing the four. I'm not sure that you would have had a place for him in today's league because didn't have that kind of versatility. At that point, he could be kind of a smallish four, maybe even a slower three. But in today's game, he didn't really have that kind of versatility. Wasn't much of a playmaker. Didn't have a great offensive repertoire. And so when he had that jumper facing him, didn't really feel comfortable with it. Wound up putting the ball down, driving into a double team of his own. And then at the last second, just didn't feel very comfortable passing the ball. Looking back at it, we all blasted Jamal Mashburn for his decision-making. It was probably not the most courageous decision. I still look at it now, and maybe with fresh eyes, a fresh perspective, it was probably a good basketball decision. Mashburn gave up probably what was another 19-footer for maybe one that was a better look from Weatherspoon. And either way, Weatherspoon put the ball down, and Mashburn wound up backpedaling past the three-point line or right around the three-point line for an open shot of his own. He was wide open. There was no defender within 10 feet of him. And so if Weatherspoon was a little bit more comfortable with the ball in his hands, might have been able to pass it either to Mashburn or Dan Marley, who actually made the entry pass into Mourning in the first place. Marley was wide open from the left wing. He could have just as easily knocked down a three-pointer a la Jim Paxson a couple years ago or Steve Kerr even. I mean, just guys that have hit big shots throughout the course of their career when they're wide open. But Weatherspoon was no Horace Grant. He didn't find Marley open from the baseline. Along the wing there. And so he wound up taking a bad shot that just wound up falling out of bounds and then rebounded by the New York Knicks. They call timeout and they wind up killing the game with about 2 seconds left. Not enough to really make a play or anything like that. And the Heat would lose for the third straight season to the New York Knicks. Heartbreaking loss here because you could just tell that they didn't have enough. If they were going to continue to lose to the Knicks, and they had done so for three straight years, and maybe even the one time that they were able to beat New York was just because they got some fluke luck after P.J. Brown had flipped Charlie Ward, and the Knicks faced suspensions as well as the Heat. But, I mean, the Heat were not as undermanned as the Knicks were, and they were actually only able to get past the New York Knicks because they were without some key personnel during that playoff run. But either way, for Miami, it was pretty obvious they might not have a championship in their future. And so it looked like changes were needed. And Pat Riley, always one willing to make those changes. I'll get into that next. You're listening to Locked On Heat. Let me tell you about one of the most useful apps that I've got on my phone. Sometimes it's hard to find the time to sit down and read and learn anymore, even with today's pandemic changing the way we live our lives. You just don't ever really have a moment. And so when you don't have that kind of free time, you can't read or work on personal development. But there's an incredible app that helps me solve this problem, and I highly recommend it. It's called Blinkist. It's really unique. It works on your phone, your tablet, your web browser, and it takes the best key takeaways, the need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books, condenses them down to just 15 minutes that you could read or listen to. There are so many opportunities to use it now when you're on the drive, when you're just sitting at home, even when you're in the bathroom. There are so many different opportunities for you to just take a few minutes to learn the kind of information that helps you grow and continue to develop. It's just such a great opportunity. Such a great app, and I really do recommend it. With Blinkist, you get unlimited access to read or listen to a massive library of condensed nonfiction books. All the books you want, tens of thousands of them, and growing every day. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/NBA, try it free for 7 days, and save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist, B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/NBA to start your free 7-day trial, and you'll get 25% off, but only when you sign up at Blinkist.com/NBA.
Give it to me. Give me that funk, that sweet, that nasty, that gushy stuff.
But don't punish me.
Mama, give me that funk, that sweet, that nasty, that gushy stuff.
Save the narrative, you save it. Remember to listen to and subscribe to new and archived episodes of Locked On Heat on Himalaya, as well as on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. If you're on iTunes, leave a rating and review, especially if it's a good one. Hopefully, this series has been an entertaining one for you. With so much unsure about the restart of the NBA season, it's always good to kind of go back in time and find out a little bit more about an era of the Heat that a lot of us have forgotten. Even me, I lived through this era, and I still don't remember much of the details that I've kind of looked through and kind of relearned over the last few days, and it's been fun for me, so I hope you're enjoying it as well. And I'd love to hear back from you and let me know what you think about the series. I'll be talking about the year 2010 next, one I've talked about recently, and I think one that's still fresh in our memories, although I can't believe it's been a decade since that. But going back to 20 years ago, in the year 2000, after their third straight loss to the New York Knicks, it was obvious that changes were needed. And Pat Riley, certainly not one to be hesitant to make those changes, made some pretty wide sweeping changes. I've talked recently about the acquisition of Tracy McGrady. That was plan A. That was the first plan. And that was what was going to be the move to propel Miami into legitimate championship contention status. Unfortunately, it didn't quite work out that way. I talked about this recently during the What If series in Miami Heat franchise history. And just to kind of go over it, absolutely go back and re-listen to that if you have not heard it already. But just if they had added McGrady, he would have just supplanted Dan Majerle in his starting lineup. They wouldn't have had to give up much because Anthony Carter, who had filled in nicely for Hardaway, was a free agent. They were looking to do a sign-and-trade with him. It probably would have cost him P.J. Brown and Anthony Carter, maybe even a pick or something like that. Not that the pick really mattered because, again, you're going to be a legitimate title contender in 2000. Fortunately, it didn't work out that way. McGrady chooses to sign with the Orlando Magic, the team that he grew up following. Actually, Grant Hill, who wound up having those lingering ankle issues, wound up joining McGrady in Orlando, and they never wound up competing for a title, mostly because of those injuries and the fact that they weren't able to really build a good roster around those players. But for Miami, they moved on to plan B really quickly. I think the shot by Mashburn, or the unwillingness to take that shot, probably made it clear to Pat Riley that he did not want Mashburn on the team. I'm not sure if that's right or not. I'm not sure if he's ever spoken publicly about Mashburn and that shot or whatnot. But my feeling is that was what the case was, that Mashburn passed up the shot and maybe Riley felt he didn't have the right stuff. He didn't have the guts, if you will. You know, Mashburn was a fascinating player, a guy who had been drafted early in the lottery by the Dallas Mavericks, and then they wound up having conflicts there between the three Jays, Jim Jackson, Jamal Mashburn, and Jason Kidd. They wound up having issues for a number of different reasons, but Mashburn was probably one of the most fascinating players in Heat history because of his versatility, a very early template for the LeBron type. I mean, not quite a Magic Johnson, but more of a versatile guy who could bring the ball up, make plays for others, could get to the rim, was a really good shooter. I mean, we kind of forget that he shot almost 40%. He was the leading three-point shooter for the Heat during the 99-2000 season. We always think of Tim Hardaway hitting big three-point shots, but it was hardly ever the best three-point shooter on the team. And so, Mashburn kind of gets overlooked, and I think the lingering memory from him is the fact that, he passed up that shot, that he gave it to Clarence Weatherspoon. I remember that was the feeling there. I also remember later on in the summer when the free agency period was right about to start, and it was the Zoe Summer Groove, the annual fundraising event that Alonzo Mourning used to host, and Eddie Jones was in attendance, and they were very clear, the Heat and everything else was very clear, in fact, that they wanted to acquire Eddie Jones from the Charlotte Hornets. And Tim Hardaway led a cheer from the fans in attendance to root for Eddie Jones, Eddie Jones being from nearby Pompano Beach and interested in joining the Heat. And unfortunately, it would have cost a sign and trade, and they would have had to trade a guy like Jamal Mashburn, who was reportedly on the radar over in Charlotte. And Jamal Mashburn was in attendance as Tim Hardaway is actively leading a cheer to acquire the guy who will replace Mashburn in the lineup. And so that was kind of brutal. I remember reading that detail, and maybe I'm misremembering it because I couldn't find anything on an internet search there. But that was kind of, that's brutal. That's a slap in the face. That's saying, you know what? I'm tired of your shit. You don't have the guts. You don't have it, whatever. We want to move on from you one way or the other. And I can't imagine that happening in today's league. I mean, if you're trying to woo any player, I mean, not even like a great superstar. It's not like they were trying to acquire a Tracy McGrady or something like that. They were trying to acquire Eddie Jones, who was a really, really good player, but you were going to give up Mashburn in order to do so. And that was kind of a slap in the face there. And unfortunately, that was the lasting memory of Mashburn until 2001, when he wound up having his comeuppance. But there were more changes there. Obviously, they wind up acquiring Eddie Jones in that sign and trade. They trade Mashburn along with P.J. Brown and Otis Thorpe to the Charlotte Hornets in exchange for Eddie Jones, Anthony Mason, and Ricky Davis. They also wind up acquiring Brian Grant in a strange three-team trade. He was with the Portland Trail Blazers. He was dying for playing time there because Rasheed Wallace was able to get past him in the lineup and kind of become that versatile 4-5 type player. So Brian Grant was a free agent. I got a lot of potential, a near all-star type player, even in the Western Conference. And so he was looking to get out of that situation in Portland, and he wound up coming to Miami in a trade that also involved Sean Kemp. I had totally forgotten about this, but this was probably the beginning of the Jailblazers, with Sean Kemp getting into some trouble and joining Rasheed Wallace and a bunch of other players that probably had some questionable run-ins with the law there. But Kemp, fat and out of shape in Cleveland and kind of disinterested at that point in his career, was moved on to Portland. Always was one of my favorite players when I was watching the league. AC Green also wound up joining the team. I talked about him in yesterday's show. He was a one-time All-Star that I could recall having played in 1990 when the event was held at the Miami Arena. AC Green, towards the tail end of his career, winds up going to play for his former coach Pat Riley, now with the Miami Heat. Vashawn Leonard had been traded to the Denver Nuggets, and along with Mark Strickland, and Clarence Weatherspoon was sent to the Cleveland Cavaliers. And so there was a penalty there for not having been able to get past the New York Knicks, and changes were necessary. Unfortunately, it didn't really matter, because in the year 2000, that summer, Alonzo Mourning would wind up playing for the USA Olympic basketball team, and that was what began the acceleration process of his kidney disease, one of the greatest what-ifs in franchise history also, something that I talked about most recently. You should definitely go back and listen to that show as well. Going back and forth, and if you recall, his wife was set to give birth at any time. And so Alonzo was flying to training camp in Las Vegas, I think it was, or California, maybe even flying back and forth during time off from Australia. And so he wanted to be there for the birth of his first child. And that kind of accelerated the process because he was doing this cross-country travel. It was incredible amount of strain on a body that was already near its breaking point, and that wound up accelerating things pretty dramatically. And so he missed almost all of the 2000 season except for the last 13 games of the year. And just to kind of touch on what happened, Mason wound up playing phenomenally. He was an impending free agent the following season, but he wound up becoming an all-star for Miami. Even with Alonzo Mourning not in the lineup, the Heat were very, very good. They had Brian Grant starting at the five. They had Mason there at the four. They had Eddie Jones kind of become almost a near all-star level player in Miami. It was just a really, really good team. And unfortunately, Alonzo kind of changed things a little bit when he came back from injury, forced things a little bit too badly. And Anthony Mason wound up taking offense to it and not really playing well. They wound up getting swept in 2001 by Mashburn and the Charlotte Hornets. But that's it for today. I'll be talking about the year 2010 next. And a special thanks goes out to Built Bar and Blinkist for sponsoring today's show. Make sure to check out Rejecting the Screen with Noah Kozlov and Adam Stanko, as well as Chad Ford's Big Board, now both on the Locked On Podcast Network. That's it for today. You can connect with me on Twitter using the hashtag AskLHeat or email me at LockedOnHeat@gmail.com. I'm David Ramil signing off, and thank you as always for your support.